one is prepared on coming downhill past the church to find the main front of this finest of Jacobean mansions, this dream of architectural beauty. No theatrical manager, no scene painter could devise anything more dramatic. And you, Columbus of the road, who steer into unwanted byways in search of the beautiful, cannot repress the involuntary tribute of an admiratory O at the sight of it. There it stands, like some proud, conscious beauty, isolated. It might be some enchanted palace, not wakened to life and love.
Thanks, Jeff, and welcome to the Country House podcast. That was an opening from Jeff, which was a quote by Charles Harper, who was a gentleman traveller from the early 20th century, and that was him first describing his first impression of Blickling Hall, which is the subject of our discussion today, famously the birthplace of Anne Boleyn. And it's amazing red brick Jacobean hall, and interestingly, legend has it that every year on the anniversary of Anne Boleyn's beheading, she arrives in a ghostly procession in a carriage carrying her severed head, with the carriage being led by four headless horses and headless horsemen. So that's quite a frightening ghostly story. It's actually one of the most notoriously haunted houses in England.
That's right, Ben. And actually, it's also said to be haunted by Anne's father, Thomas Boleyn, who owned the house. And it's said it's where his three children, Anne, Mary and George, were born. And Anne's father, Thomas Boleyn, is said to also haunt the house. It's said that having engineered his daughter's marriage to England's monarch, Henry VIII, and because of his wrongdoings, he lost his daughter and his son. And as penance, he is required to cross a dozen bridges before cockcrow for 1,000 years, taking a route through Norfolk, carrying his head under his arms, and a flame is said to gush from his mouth instead of blood.
Gosh. Well, if we haven't scared you off by now, we're going to try and redeem ourselves by perhaps stating some reasons why you should go and visit. And I wonder, Connor, if you could let us into the drive up and what you can first expect from Blickling Estate.
Yes, Ben, to set the scene, Blickling is this magnificent country house in the Norfolk countryside. So you can imagine the fields of cattle and old oak and chestnut and beech and other trees, and driving down a country lane, appearing on your right-hand side is this magnificent symmetrical approach to the house. That approach is flanked from the beginning by tall yew hedges, which are famous in Blickling. As you reach closer to the house, you are flanked by the stable block, behind which on both sides is the engine room of the house, in the sense of its utilitarian, its working, its farm buildings. Whereas in this courtyard, on your approach, it is symmetrical, dressed stone brickwork, dormer windows, Dutch gables, tall chimneys with stone dressings. And in front of you now, upon this entire descent to the house, is the symmetrical facade. The centerpiece is Dutch gables and a cupola atop the roof. It's flanked either side by end pavilions. And in comparison to many country houses, well, all country houses really post the late 17th century, this is very much in the English tradition of the mullion and leaded windows, which came before the sash. It has oriel windows, strapwork, pediments to the upper windows, and also decorative balustrading, but different from what you'd expect of the Italian classical tradition that we see in so many other country houses. So this is very much a statement house. There's symmetry, order, and the house you see today was built in 1619, built upon the ruins, the former site of the Boleyn castle, or rather manor house. And, well, we can talk about then moving inside and what you'd expect from there.
Thanks, Connor. I think it's probably worth saying that, although not entirely certain, the architect attributed to Blickling is Robert Leminge, who is most famous for building Hatfield House, one of the great prodigy houses of England, the seat of the Marquess of Salisbury in Hertfordshire. And you can certainly see a lot of similarities. Again, Hatfield was late Elizabethan, early Jacobean. And again, it's got the brickwork, the red brickwork, and the stone dressings. The Italianate style was coming in. The Cecils, who live still at Hatfield, were great patrons of the English Renaissance. And they were the great patrons also of Robert Leminge, this architect, who built Hatfield and then subsequently Blickling. And so you can certainly see some early Italianate influences, although not nearly as overt as the Georgian and Palladian architecture of later decades and centuries. There's certainly some. And interestingly, Connor, you touched on the, before we talk about the interiors as well as the parkland of gardens, it's worth commenting on the gables, which Hatfield doesn't have and which are so, there are so many of at Blickling. And in fact, in Norfolk in general, there are lots of gables. I think of other great houses in Norfolk, such as Raynham Hall and many of the medium or smaller manor houses, which have gables. And that is because there's a huge Dutch influence in Norfolk, which stems from when the Huguenots, the persecuted Huguenots from the Netherlands and Holland and France, fled persecution from the Catholics and fled to England. And they came across to Norfolk, where they could still trade as merchants. They could still trade wools and silks with Europe. So many of the Dutch descendants settled in Norfolk. And that's a large reason why Norfolk, as well as other seaside towns, coastal towns, I'm thinking of Topsham, for example, in near Exeter, which also has many gables because it was a trading village on the coast. But in Norfolk especially, there are many Dutch gables because of that Dutch influence. And therefore, although the family who built Blickling after the Boleyns, it was the Hobart family who built Blickling, but they weren't Dutch, but it was fashionable in the area to have gables, which is why you have that wonderful avenue of gabled stables ending in the gabled facade of Blickling Hall.
That's fascinating. And you then step into the entrance hall, which is magnificent. And I think there are two real key things that take your attention immediately as you step in, which is the timber staircase and this amazing stained glass window that I think predates the actual building itself, but it's loads of panels of separate religious stories of the life of Christ or the Annunciation and stuff. But Connor, you've done some research on the entrance hall. What have you learned about it?
Yes, the entrance hall, impressive staircase as you enter, but what you're seeing is the creation of the second Earl, John Hobart. The previous staircase was a single stair in another room behind the wall of that entrance hall that we see today. In the center, so you rise a flight of stairs onto a landing that divides left and right, and so you carry on up to the next floor. But in that center piece on the landing above it is the stained glass window, which does, as you say, predate the house, and it is of biblical scenes, I believe the Nativity. And that was put in 1802, although it predates the house, and it is the most impressive part of the hall. But rising from the entrance hall, once you go up that beautifully crafted stairs, you enter the library. And this is probably the most impressive room of the house, designed as a long gallery. I believe it's 120 feet long. So this is a place that guests, family would spend a lot of time. And what is most impressive when you enter this room is the plasterwork ornate ceiling, which has emblems, devices, coat of arms. And the first image that you see above your head when you enter the library, I believe, is Doctrina, the Lady of Learning. And she's holding up a lamp with a book, and of course, appropriate to library. But now that's the ceiling. Around you at this point, to set the scene, it's a long room, so long and narrow, but on the walls are bookcases, and they are of dark timber with a sort of cage in front of the books. And there are 12,500 volumes in this library. So the books there date back many centuries, from Jane Austen to medieval authors. And for the library alone, a lot of people visit this house, Blickling Hall.
Thanks, Connor. It's probably worth saying that actually the library, the core collection of the library, was formed not by the Hobarts, or actually, as you're supposed to pronounce the name, Hubbard, which is quite interesting. It's like their neighbours, the Chumleys, over at Houghton Hall, and like many other grand families, the pronunciation of the name is very different to the spelling. So they spelt Hobart, it's pronounced Hubbard. Actually, like their descendants, the Carrs, whose surname is spelt Kerr, it's interesting that that so many of these houses, they sort of, it's a way to differentiate people, I suppose, how you pronounce the name. But a cousin of the Hubbards was Sir Richard Ellis, who was a bibliophile in the 17th century. He was a Whig politician who sat in the Commons between 1701 and 1734. He was a theological writer as well, and he was a baronet who collected rare books. And upon his death, his collection of books went to the Hubbards at Blickling. And subsequently, that was when the library was expanded and built. And it is home to some extraordinary books. The Blickling Homilies, for example, are a collection of homilies from Anglo-Saxon England written in Old English, probably what the house is most famous for. But they also have the Lothian Psalter, which is an 8th century illuminated Psalter, which is now housed in a museum, I think, in New York. But it was formerly in the Blickling Library. So it's interesting. There's on a slight tangent, there's probably the most exclusive club in the world is the Roxbury Club, which is still going. It's a very small club for bibliophiles. And specifically, one of the prerequisites for joining the Roxbury Club is you have to have an extraordinary collection. So we're talking about people like the Duke of Devonshire and the Duke of Norfolk, amongst others, are members of this very exclusive little dining club that still meets today. But I have no doubt if Blickling was still in family hands, the Marquesses of Lothian would be members of the Roxbury Club. They may well still be, but because the collection there is quite extraordinary.
It's probably one of the most significant collections in England. The oldest is from 1100. It's the dialogues of Pope Gregory the Great, which is kind of cool, isn't it? But I wanted to just touch on the ceiling again, Connor, because it was so impressive. And I found out that it's the whole ceiling is based off Henry Peacham's Minerva Britannia, which, if you don't know, is kind of a crazy book. It's like a code book almost, with loads of codes and hermetic things of and fairy tale scenes, very Renaissance. And you can see, as you look closely, some other emblems you can find is depictions of the five senses as you walk by. So there's someone blindfolded with a bouquet of flowers in front of them, or there's someone sipping some wine for taste. I thought that was really interesting. And I guess, would that, because that would have previously to being the library, would have been the Long Gallery, would that have been made as a talking point for guests walking through that, and conversation starters?
Yes, as you walk around, there are different images and would strike conversation, and as you mentioned, blindfolded, there's an image of Hercules blindfolded, carrying the world. But at the center of this ceiling is the coat of arms of the family. And dotted around the ceiling, and I believe throughout the estate and the house, you will find the bull. So this is the family animal, the emblem. It's associated with the coat of arms. And it shows that, as we've mentioned in previous episodes, that the country house is first and foremost a family home. And so with collections, with some of the artwork, you'll find it's a lot of gifts, it's family friends. So even in that library, the frieze, which I believe is early 20th century arts and crafts by William Morris, this is a family friend. And every time he came to the house, he added to the frieze, creating what you see today. And it was in his stay and as a friend that he made this, and it ties the room together. It takes color, I believe, from the stained glass window and some of the strap work detailing that you see in the ceiling. So it unites the room, brings it all together architecturally. But the reason I mentioned the bull and the coat of arms is to show that this is not a museum. It has the country house throughout the land. They are providing the collections of the history of the country and, I suppose, bastions of tradition in that sense. But they are first and foremost family homes, and we see that in the ceiling. Beautiful to look at, that ceiling, but it is at its heart a representation of the family.
That's lovely, Connor, and it's lovely about the William Morris, story of him coming and adding to the frieze over his many visits. It creates a lovely personal touch, and actually we can talk more about the evolution of the house over the centuries. It might be quite helpful for our listeners now just to quickly run through the descent and how it ended up in the hands of the National Trust. So I'll quickly run through the history. So after being built by the Hubbards, it remained, in fact, Sir John Hubbard, who was the second baronet, who completed the building of the house, ran up such huge debts that they actually had to forestall their creditors. But he did marry an heiress. He married Frances Egerton, who was the daughter of the Earl of Bridgewater, and she helped settle the debts. It passed on to her it passed on to Sir John Hubbard, who in turn. His grandson, the fifth baronet, also Sir John, was created the Earl of Buckinghamshire in 1746. And he was the one who, as the first Earl of Buckinghamshire, in line with his elevated status and elevation to the peerage, sort of expanded and worked on the house and grounds. So he built the Ha Ha, he built the Doric Temple and the grounds, creating parkland. It was his son, the second Earl, who remodeled the hall between 1765 and 1785. And I think it was the second Earl, am I right in saying, Connor, who commissioned Humphrey Repton to redo the park. So when the house was built in the Jacobean times, the gardens would have been formal gardens. They would have been parterres. They would have been not gardens. They would have been avenues and hedges, and it was under Humphrey Repton that the house had a parkland created around it, which is why it's interesting that the house isn't set within a park like many of the Palladian and Georgian houses, which were built at the same time as their parks, and you had long sweeping drives, as Connor's described in previous episodes, approaching the house. Whereas Blickling, although the park was created behind the house, and you've got the Serpentine Lake, you've got the trees, you've got the sort of beautiful Arcadia that is created to the rear and the side of the house. The approach is still a straight avenue from the main road. So it's a throwback to the fact that the house would have all been straight lines, straight avenues running out on axes from the house, surrounded by knot gardens and parterres. And just continuing through with the history of the house and its descent, the second Earl's daughter Caroline, married to Lord Suffield, inherited the house. And she died childless. So the house devolved to Caroline's nephew, William Carr, who was the 8th Marquess of Lothian. So that's how the house entered the possession of the Lothian family, the Carr family, who remodeled the West Front. And the house then descended through the Carrs, who have many other houses across the country and huge landholdings in Scotland. And it was in the Carr family until it was given to the National Trust in 1940 upon the death of the 11th Marquess of Lothian, Philip Carr, who again died childless. And his title was inherited by a cousin, but the house was given to the trust as part of the Country House scheme. And Ben, perhaps you can expand a little bit more on the Country House scheme.
Well, I was just going to say before that, some interesting points about the Carr family that you mentioned, that it was through having no children, it was passed to the Carrs. William Carr, the 8th Marquess of Lothian, who was actually 9 years old when he inherited that estate, which I couldn't imagine being a 9-year-old today and inheriting that. But he was married quite early and spent his days traveling all over the world with his wife. And I think at even one point he had the future Prime Minister of India come and visit him after one of his travels to India. But talking about the evolution of the house, he made a lot of changes to reflect those travels. So when you're in there, you can see hints to North Africa, Asia, and parts of Europe in collections and design features. But this traveling ultimately caused his demise, because when he was 38, he caught a disease in India, which led to his death, quite sadly. But then later on, we have Philip Carr, the 11th Marquess of Lothian, who actually, when you talk about the country house schemes and stuff, as we were mentioning, without Blickling Hall and without Philip, we may not have many of the country houses that we still do today, because he was a very, very good statesman and served in some high up capacity to Lloyd George, I think, and with that influence was able to be the driving force behind the National Trust Act of 1937, and basically created the Country House scheme. So yeah, thanks to them we still have all of these today.
That's right, Ben. So the Country House scheme was essentially where families could bequest houses to the trust in lieu of death duties, and in the period surrounding and directly after the Second World War, obviously death duties were huge, and families were encouraged, and Philip Carr, the 11th Marquess, set a precedent. He was, you're right, private secretary to Lloyd George. He was also famous for his very liberal politics. He was very pro the appeasement of Hitler, for example, couldn't stand Winston Churchill, who he saw as a warmonger, and he actually died mid Second World War. He died in December 1940, when the house had actually just been requisitioned by RAF Alton, where it was used as the officers' mess during World War II. So Philip Carr left it to the trust, but it continued to be in the hands of the RAF until the end of the Second World War. And during that time, the house looked very different to how it looks today. So there were Nissen huts where the servicemen and women were billeted, dotted all around the grounds. The lake, the lovely Serpentine Lake, is where the RAF used to practice dinghy drills during the Second World War. So what to do if they, for example, had to parachute out of a plane and be in a dinghy, how they would do that. And then after the war, the house was derequisitioned, but the trust didn't have the money to restore it and open it to the public. And so it was actually leased to another politician, Somerset de Cher, who leased it for 15 years until 1960, when the trust took back the house from Somerset de Cher and restored it and opened it to the public. And it's been open to the public since 1962. And I think in recent years, it attracts around 250,000 visitors a year. So it's a big tourist attraction in Norfolk, and it's well worth a visit.
Yes, the National Trust, in fact, call it the jewel in their crown in Norfolk. So it is, amongst all National Trust properties, it is one of the, I suppose, most famous. But it's quite remarkable that the house left the family in the 1940s. The gardens you see today were designed, the parterre gardens directly beside the house, were designed in the 1930s. And to think that only 10 or so years later, it was gone from the family. But thinking back to the changes to the house, that although built, as we see today, built by Henry Hobart, it was his son, the second Earl, who really left quite a stamp on the house in terms of building the dynasty and saying the Hobarts have arrived. It was he that added that entrance hall, by creating the stairs in that approach. He put in the stained glass, and also continuing our journey through the house from the library, there's also the great drawing room, which originally was three rooms, and he broke it. He broke the three rooms into one in order to house the tapestry of Peter the Great, which is, I think, 21 feet tall. That was a gift from Catherine the Great after John Hobart served as British ambassador for 2 years. The color of the room itself, just to build an image for the audience, it's an apricot color room. It's got silk on the walls, and the ceiling is something from Pompeii or Herculaneum in its classical design. And it's design of William Wilkins. It got an Axminster carpet, and it's either side of the fireplace that is in the center of the room. You have a portrait of him and her, the husband and wife, John and his wife. And on the wall to your left, looking at the fireplace, is George III on a horse. So each generation leaves their mark on the house. And with the landscape and this drawing room and the changes to the entrance hall, the second Earl John certainly did.
Connor, itself, you mentioned the tapestry that came from Catherine the Great's collection. It's funny, bringing us back to the present day. In 2021, the National Trust actually deployed a parasitic wasp to the house, because the house is blighted by moths, which were gradually eating away at this famous tapestry. And so rather than using chemicals, they've released swarms of parasitic wasps, which are absolutely tiny, but they eat the moth's eggs. They were released in the hall in February 2021 to try and combat the decay of these tapestries and other fabrics by the common moth. It's funny, you also mentioned how the gardens were done in the 1930s by, well, not the gardens, the parkland was done, as you mentioned, Connor, started by the second Earl, who removed all traces of formality and started to create the landscape garden we see today. It was his daughter, the Lady Caroline Suffield, in turn left the house to the Carrs, who commissioned Humphrey Repton to continue building the parkland. But it was, what was interesting, it was only after, and the garden then remained the same until the 1930s, when disparaging comments in no other than Country Life magazine embarrassed Philip Lothian, the Marks of Lothian, so much that he commissioned Nora Lindsay to remodel the gardens around the house, replacing tiny flower beds with large square beds and herbaceous borders. So you've got the mix of the parkland setting, and then you've got things like the Temple Walk with azaleas and lots of sort of contemporary plants from the early 20th century. But something else in the garden, which, Connor, you could talk a little bit more about, which contrasts with the house, is the classical orangery that was built by, I think, Humphrey Repton. And maybe, Connor, you can tell our listeners a little bit more about the purpose of the orangery and why it looks so lovely within the setting of Blickling.
Yes, in contrast to the house, the orangery is a classical building of the 1780s. And Humphrey Repton, who designed the landscape, also designed the orangery. And this is quite common with landscape architects, landscape gardeners, such as Capability Brown, not only designing the landscape, but some of the buildings, the follies that sit within that. And to set the scene of this orangery, it is a long building, not very deep, with end pavilions of arches and pediments, and they are linked throughout the center by very tall pilasters crowned by a cornice, Doric pilasters. The reason for the orangery, as its name, is for citrus fruits. So this was somewhere through from the 17th to 19th century. You could show off your gardener's skills, but also provide citrus fruits in the house for guests. And that was proof of the prosperity of the estate, that they could operate such a system. Now, even though it's not used for its original purpose as an orangery, it is still a beautiful building. And I believe the National Trust rented out for events. And it stands today in excellent condition, I believe.
That's right. And what's interesting with the orangery is it had a double purpose. It housed the citrus fruits, the citrus trees, during the colder months of the year in lovely terracotta pots. And what's interesting is with orangeries, you'll notice that there's often ramps or stone ramps leading up to the doors. And it's because these pots were on casters and they'd be wheeled out in the summer months to line the avenues surrounding the house. And then the orangery would be used as a summer house for tea or dinner parties. And then as the months drew, as the months got colder, so the citrus trees would be wheeled back into the orangery, and it would create a lovely European or Mediterranean vibe. They could take guests in the winter months for walks into the orangery, and often these orangeries were heated, like you learn about magnolia houses and greenhouses, such as the ones at Chatsworth, which had their own coal furnaces that would heat the greenhouses and orangeries. I don't know if the one at Blickling was heated, but they were utilitarian buildings as well as beautiful buildings. And it's interesting, Connor, you mentioned how it's now being used in a different way by the National Trust. Ben, what are your thoughts as we draw this episode to a close about Blickling?
Well, first off, it is beautiful. It is really beautiful. And it's obviously very popular too. I mean, in 2019, they had just under 250,000 visitors. So we were discussing one of the largest houses the other week, Wentworth Woodhouse. And I think we found that that had 60,000 visitors in a year. So you can see it's obviously a really beloved house.
It's interesting, actually, Blickling, if you look at it in Google Maps, you see just Norfolk is famous both for its flatness, but also for its plethora of country houses, larger, which are still privately owned. And it means that Norfolk is a beautiful county. And if you look at Blickling on Google Maps, it's funny. It almost looks like one enormous park because it backs onto so many other houses with parks. So although Blickling is by far the most beautiful, you have Walterton Hall, Walterton Park, which was one of the Walpole's houses, which has recently been restored and featured a lot in magazines in recent years, with Capability Brown Parkland. That's just to the north of the house. You have so many houses sort of on all around it. And it must have been extraordinary in the year, and Hayden Hall's not far. Hayden's a beautiful house as well. It must have been extraordinary back in the day when all these houses were privately owned, and you sort of could hop in a carriage and in 10 or 15 minutes be at a neighboring estate and enjoy the parties, and all the workers would have been devoted to their estates, but would have known the workers probably on rival estates. Norfolk is also famous for its good agricultural land. So although Blickling now is only 5,000 acres, it would have been much more than that back in its heyday. Those 5,000 acres of arable land are very good quality soil. So the farmland is still farmed by the trust. I think of the 5,000 acres Blickling has, I think 3,500 are still farmed. and the trust uses it as commercial farms.
Yes. Jeff, just to continue and to close, I suppose, on the landscape, you can appreciate from looking at it on Google Earth, but also when you're there, that the house is not sitting in the center of the parkland as you'd expect of an 18th century Georgian country house, but it is at the heart of its design. Like a sunburst, the trees emanate from the house to the northwest. There is an avenue cut through the wood, creating a channel view to the east, and the lake extends from the house to the north. And so you can really see that it's not sitting in the heart of the parkland, but everything relates directly to the house. And then from the entrance, of course, that long drive with the tall yew trees and flanked by the stables, when you turn around, you see open parkland, open fields extending right into the distance, flanked by forest. But it's clear that the house is what is dictating the placement of trees, the openings, the planting, and although not sitting at the heart, it is the heart of the design and the wider scheme.
That's fascinating. Thanks for letting us know that, Connor. And Jeff, one more thing that Norfolk is famous for, of course, is Alan Partridge, the played by Steve Coogan, which Alan Partridge was filmed at Blickling Hall. There's an episode of I'm Alan Partridge that was filmed there, as well as slightly contrasting Sense and Sensibility was filmed there too. So there are a couple of things that have used Blickling Hall as a filming location, but do go and visit it if you have the opportunity. But just beware when you're there of the notorious hauntings, and it's known that Anne Boleyn freezes the air when she walks past you in the house. So if you get a shiver, just you can think it's her. But thank you for joining us, and goodbye.